Welcome back to the R Squared podcast. I'm Ian Levy. I've been hosting this podcast for 2 years, and I've, in that time, I've amassed a grand total of 17 episodes. What you're listening to is the 18th. So I've said this before at different points, but as we enter this new season, I'm really hoping to make this podcast a regular thing. My schedule has changed, and my plans are to, if not weekly, be uploading new episodes at least twice a month. So hopefully this is a good opportunity to get reacquainted with the podcast if you're an old listener, or get familiar with it if you're a new listener, and looking forward to having lots more great conversations for you in the future. Today's episode is with Seth Partnow. He's been on the pod several times before. Since the last time we talked with him, he's taken over as managing editor of Nylon Calculus. You can also find him at Washington Post Fancy Stats blog and a few other sites around the internet. Seth, welcome back. It's been a long time since we recorded, and you've been a machine this summer, just churning out great insights. So wanted to have you back on today to talk about some of the work you did this summer, talk about the upcoming season, some of the teams you're excited about, stuff like that. How you doing?
Doing pretty good. It's getting on to actual winter here in Alaska, so that's means the season's about to start, but it also means it's almost winter in Alaska.
Yeah, time to get locked down inside. And we should tell the listeners that it's what, about 6:30 a.m. your time as we're recording this.
Sure.
So forgive any grogginess on Seth's part. So you were prolific this summer. Seemed like having the space to be away from newsy stuff and new stuff coming out gave you time to really dig into these data sets you've been playing with all year. What was some of the stuff that you did this summer that you were really excited about?
I think one of the things that actually seemed kind of obvious, but it turned out to be much more useful than I thought it was going to be, was just coming up with kind of the lineups and positional data stuff, and so to being able to kind of as an estimate, it's not perfect because you know, I think we've talked about it before, kind of how squishy positional definitions are anyway. But just to be able to look and see, like, okay, here's what Anthony Davis did as a center. Here's what he did as a power forward. And, you know, to kind of be able to look at lineups and players in kind of that level of detail. And not just, you know, there are plenty of resources on to be able to do that kind of in an aggregate sense, but to be able to break it down a little more finally and see for myself kind of, okay, what shots are happening if Anthony Davis is playing here or there. So I think that turned out to be one of the more useful. It was kind of as I was doing it, it was definitely like a step to something else, and then it became its own thing.
And the positional definitions that you defined, so because you did a lot of work with it this summer, and it took different shapes in different places. But one of the things that I liked, and you used this last year with your rim protection stats and a couple other things too, is that you you sort of went broad with some of the categories. So your sort of base positional designations are point guard, wing, and big. Is that right?
Depends. For the rim protection, I actually went back to traditional five positions, just because working with some of the more granular bingo, since apparently that's a word I overuse, but the more granular data that our friend and colleague Daryl Blackport has has supplied us with, just the difference between the kind of the rim protection average almost of a power forward and a center turned out to be actually even a little bigger than I thought it was previously. So or that it had been when I was using kind of slightly muddier data. So I actually kind of expanded back out, just because it was, you know, under my method, it was like a 2.5 point per 36 minute difference in terms of room. And that was, you know, huge.
fairly significant.
Because all the perimeter players, all you know, the absolute numbers don't matter that much, but you know, the perimeter players all scale to about average about 2 points saved per 36. Power forwards are a little over 5, and centers are 8. And so lumping players together between those two started to make less sense rather than treating them as separate things, because I think that better reflects, you know, the game as played on the floor, where kind of the one big man tends to be, you know, out chasing pick and rolls out to the arc and doing all that kind of stuff, and the other one tends to drop into the paint and protect. I think on most teams that better reflects reality than treating them as the same thing.
Well, it's interesting because I imagine there's some cases where differentiating, I imagine there's some questions that you would want to answer where differentiating between power forwards and centers matter, like this rim protection you're talking about. And then there's other cases where the differentiation really matters between bigs and wings, like that's the inflection point where it's really important, and getting beyond that is not adding any value.
Yeah, though, I mean, again, with the way the power forward position is changing, I think like kind of point wing power forward center might almost be, because I think what you're getting at is that in across many kind of things, the differentiation between kind of shooting guard and small forward is not all that great. But then, you know, the many different ways that there are to play kind of whatever you call the four in the NBA now kind of makes that a different thing than the center position. I mean, the number of centers who shoot meaningful number of threes is pretty small, whereas it's increasingly common and almost, I wouldn't say necessity, but it's becoming a very common thing for, you know, power forwards to do that. And so that's, you know, how many threes do big shoot? Well, that's, you know, you're lumping two things in there together, and it's not necessarily, because if you take out the guys who tend to shoot none, you know, the traditional centers, the Tyson Chandlers or Jonas Valanciunases or stuff like that, then you get a very different answer than just, you know, the average of all of them.
And so the positional definitions that you're defining when you get down to the five positions, how are you separating? What's the criteria for power forwards versus centers?
I didn't try to do any kind of statistical groupings or anything like that. It was more just that these are the five positions on the floor, because really, I mean, almost what more important than anything else is trying to define matchups a little bit. So if Indiana is playing Paul George at the four this year, I'm calling that power forward by convenience, mostly because if the other team is playing a traditional lineup, that's who he's likely guarding on the other team, is their power forward. So that's, you know, more important than saying, you know, a power forward does this. It's just seeing like, most ball handly and smallest to most rim protecting and biggest, where on that scale is the player in this particular lineup?
Because the point being then that you're making some manual distinctions.
Yes.
It's like the problem with Basketball Reference with their positional estimates, which were a great step forward when they first had them, is I think they're almost entirely by height.
Yeah.
So you had a situation last year with like with the Bucks, where I think Chris Middleton is 6'8" and Dudley's listed at 6'7". So even though Dudley was functioning as the small ball power forward in all of those lineups, Basketball Reference treats Middleton as the power forward because he's, you know, listed as an inch taller.
And the bigger one, because the Bucks are interesting just because they're, you know, through kind of they do so much switching, kind of 2 through 4, who's playing what
maybe matters less than that.
Yeah, it's a little bit more malleable. You know, you might even argue that Giannis was the four, but then again, he handled the ball a ton, whereas Middleton and Dudley were kind of spotting up more. So
yeah,
you know, defining positions for kind of those mid-sized teams is tough. But even the more important example, I think, would be like Golden State, where you know, Basketball Reference would have Harrison Barnes playing above, you know, a bigger position than Draymond Green, and which that just doesn't reflect how Golden State, you know, Harrison Barnes at times like guarded power forwards, but that was when, you know, Draymond Green was playing center.
So I
can't think, even against like Memphis, I can't think of times where, you know, they had Bogut, Barnes, and Green on the floor, and you would say that Green was playing, quote, small forward defensively.
Yeah, but that's another situation where it was dictated by height, right?
Yes.
Because Barnes is listed as an inch taller than Green.
And then there's also just some, like special cases where, you know, one situation that I had to kind of manually adjust is New Orleans, where, you know, if they're playing their three main perimeter guys together, then, you know, Drew Holiday has the ball and Eric Gordon's the two guard and Tyreke Evans is the small forward. That makes sense. But if without, you know, manually adjusting it, then if it's just Gordon and Evans on the floor, it would have come out that Gordon was the point guard, and that's not right. So just kind of certain situations where kind of flipping people here or there is necessary. But yeah,
so this is one of those cases, I think, right, where people who are maybe skeptical of advanced analytics talk about how the numbers can't fully capture something like positionality because the maybe it's because like the features of positionality are things that maybe we can't sort of totally measure, and then they differ from context to context, team to team, and things like that. So the manual adjustments are a step forward, but you know, you can't realistically do manual adjustments for everything, you know, you couldn't go back, you know, whatever 15 years worth of lineup data and do those manual adjustments. It'd take you know, forever.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think at the time I could have, you know, just a lot of it is you know, careful attention to the league. So going forward, it's something that's you know, certainly plausible. And, you know, there are people, there's been some academic work and other stuff about kind of doing some kind of clustering analysis to come up with, you know, whether at the kind of the normally defined positions or I think John Nichols, who now is the analytics guy for the Cavs or the head analytics guy for the Cavs, did some work a while ago kind of breaking positions down even further into kind of roles. And that's, I think all that's, you know, very possible. And it's just a matter it's almost an 80-20 thing in that, I just need to get close, and then from there it's a lot of it is you know, using some actual judgment and basketball as played on the floor experience to contextualize what the numbers are saying.
And for you, right, like that's the point of this work this summer, is that the positionality then it's not to make a list of, well, who are actually point guards and who's the best true point guard, or, you know, whatever those silly questions are. It's then to understand how skills fit together, how lineups are built, like how offenses and defenses function, right?
You know, what are we, you know, revolting against within the positional revolution, just kind of so, and also, yes, to see what, you know, if you have a point guard who doesn't do point guard things, what are the, you know, the air quotes as necessary, what are the skills that you're having to replace with the other players? If Patrick Beverley isn't really, you know, a ball handler, offensive creator guy, what things does that mean James Harden has to do now? Or and now with the addition of Ty Lawson, does he have to do less of now? So that's, I think those are, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, like, is it, how much of a waste of kind of Serge Ibaka's uniqueness is it to kind of make him fill the hole that is Enes Kanter's, you know, no, I mean, seriously though, it's, I mean, that's, that, you know, maybe neither here nor there, but, that's, well, we can get away with it 'cause we have Serge Ibaka. It's like, well, yes, but that's like giving away the advantage you have from having Serge Ibaka. So anyway, dislike of that, you know, contract will live on. Yeah.
So one of my favorite things that you did this year, it was not quite positionality, but sort of using this data and thinking about that idea, was the Bully Ball article, which you wrote about. And then you did the great Inside the Numbers video series we're doing at Nylon Calculus with Adam. Then we'll link to that as well. But so the Bully Ball article, the idea was defining post-up opportunities or shot attempts out of post-ups, and then looking at closest defender and looking at height advantage, right? So you're looking at post ups where the offensive player has a significant height advantage, and then looking at the score.
I didn't look at height advantage. I looked at that kind of position advantage. So it would capture. I mean, if there's
misunderstanding.
No, it's okay. If there's a guy like Jared Dudley or Draymond Green who's playing a lot of power forward, presumably they're doing it well enough to not just get destroyed in that position. I think looking into the data kind of backed that up, that even that guys who tended to play up tended to be guys who weren't disastrous at it. So, I'm almost outsourcing the wisdom of who can credibly guard the post to NBA coaches that way. Cause I mean, the people they had guarding the post were people who could guard the post. So I kind of looked at kind of, positional mismatches in that way, like, you know, playing against guys used to playing smaller, basically.
From that article, I think the absolute least surprising insight from that article was that Hibbert was terrible at taking advantage of his size when he had a smaller matchup. And from watching him the past couple of years in Indiana, you'd see how often they would try and slow their offense down and try and create a mismatch for him in the post and let him go to work, and how rarely that worked.
I think that's in the modern NBA, that right there just is bad offense. Full stop. It's it's too easy to push a guy too far out on the floor if you're just, you know, I think Adam and I talked about this, but, you know, if you're catching the ball with your back to the basket 10 feet away, that's not really it's typically throwing to a guy who isn't the greatest passer or ball handler. Like, how is that an advantageous situation? I've been looking for it, you know, when I've watched preseason this year, to the extent that I've been able to watch preseason, because, you know, your brain kind of clicks off after 5 minutes. But just looking for if teams are, and I think they are, trying to do, you know, slightly more clever things to get people the ball on the move a little bit, and so they're, you know, catching the ball with their back to the basket, but their back almost literally to the basket, if you've got the small guy on you. You actually just want to bury him under the rim and then dunk it on him, not like, all right, I'm going to back you down from 10 feet because I'm bigger. It's like, that's very time consuming, and all kinds of things can go wrong. So that's neither of which make it the most efficient offensive strategy.
Yeah.
So
were there other things that came out of that Bully Ball article that were surprising to you?
I think some of it is also just, I'd like to be able to, like, get a little more fine grain with the data to be able to, because there are some guys who qualitatively are kind of pick and roll finishers, and they obviously finish like madmen over, you know, the smaller rotation defender, you know, your Tyson Chandler's or your Kenneth Faried even is another example of that. And so to be able to better distinguish between, you know, which is kind of guys who are better at finishing those situations over, you know, the help defender or who happens to be smaller, or those guys who are able to, you know, all right, you're gonna play small ball against LaMarcus Aldridge. All right, well, here, you just scored again. And I think he's one of an example of a guy who can take advantage. And I think, you know, based on his skill set, I don't think that's super surprising. I mean, he's a good jump shooter who is mobile enough to get the ball in good spots, and a good enough passer and a low enough turnover player that he can, that can become a more valuable play than, you know, you see the kind of the lumbering behemoth and, mm-hmm. and try to, well, he'll just overpower and get called for an offensive foul,
So the obvious extension of that article or the whatever mirrored sort of idea would be to look at small players attacking off the dribble against players who are bigger. Is that something that's manageable with the data?
You can, to some extent, you can...
I mean, I know we can't define drives necessarily the way SportView defines them without some serious algorithmic work, but something like, you know, number of dribbles and touch time, you know, against a guy who's bigger than them, something like that.
I think especially from the public data, working out, like, who's guarding whom when becomes – and that's, again, that's a similar problem to, you know, trying to figure out which was a post up, which was like a, you know, a cut to the basket or, you know, a play out of the pick and roll. I have looked at times at, you know, both offensively and defensively, you know, situations where guys are shooting jump shots off the dribble over, over bigger guys. It should surprise nobody that Steph Curry and Chris Paul are absurd in that situation. Trey Burke was awful. off the top, those are the ones I remember off the top of my head. Just and then it's hard to look at like defensively because I think there was maybe like four or five guys in the league who, you know, defended kind of quote unquote defended. Like more than 100 shots last season in that situation. So it's like, how much do we really believe about, you know, this guy was good or bad, or, you know, they just happened to make three shots in a row on him kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Moving on from the stuff you did this summer, you wrote for Sports Illustrated, the Cauldron vertical at Sports Illustrated earlier this week about the Houston Rockets, and you're bullish on the Houston Rockets. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I'm cautiously bullish just because you know, it's a hard road for them, but it's like they've been kind of relegated to it seems alongside, you know, the Warriors who, you know, them not being the favorites for the West still kind of confuses me, to be honest. And the, you know, the Spurs, Clippers, Thunder are all just to kind of assume, oh, they'll be right there. Oh yeah. And Houston has seemed to be, and it's, you see that in everything from kind of the preseason odds. When I wrote that, you know, all of the Houston's at 20-1, I think they're at 16-1 now. To win the title. I'm not sure if I haven't been monitoring that every day. But still, all the four that I mentioned were all like under 10-1. And it's like, well, Houston's that much worse than those. I disagree. And so, a large part of it is I think that there's, you know, Houston isn't necessarily a likable team for a variety of reasons. And I think that dislike kind of is overly, I don't know if it's colored the analysis so much as that it's subjected them to more scrutiny than some other teams have gotten. I mean, you know, Oklahoma City has a strange roster and a coach who's never coached in the NBA, and you know, Kevin Durant's free agency distraction possibly lingering, and so on and so forth. You know, the Spurs, I mean, they have some kind of roster recombobulation issues themselves. And what happens if Tony Parker is just old? You know, they don't really have anyone else on the roster who does kind of what he can do. All respect to Patty Mills. And the Clippers, you know, the bench is revamped. Is it good? You know, it's not like it's you know, if you're talking about, you know, the head case concerns with the Rockets, then you look at the Clippers bench and you kind of, okay, like, why are we not asking those same questions? So that's kind of the question I'm asking is like, all right, if we're gonna, like, you know, put Houston under the microscope, we need to put these other teams under the same microscope. And you know, and on the positive side of the ledger, there's a lot of really interesting things that they can do.
So one of the things I thought was interesting is so since the Rockets made this Lawson addition, and assuming that he, you know, assuming that he is sort of functional and is no more legal trouble and is able to play and stay healthy, whatever, this year, everybody has sort of been talking about him as a complement to Harden and, you know, him as sort of a secondary ball handler. And how's he going to, you know, how's he, his spot up shooting should improve dramatically because he didn't get to do much of that in Denver. He always had the ball, and now playing next to Harden, you know, as a spot up shooter, he's going to be great. But I know you, I think it came in an email thread and then and touched on in the article too, but the idea of Harden playing off of Lawson instead of Lawson, maybe situations where Lawson can be the primary ball handler and Harden is that secondary creator who's attacking after the defense has already shifted, or he's the one spotting up on the outside.
Well, yeah, I think Harden's probably Houston's best spot up shooter. So, mm-hmm. but you can't spot up for yourself because you need someone to throw you the ball. So that that's one area that it frees him up. And also, like, you know, he's a with his crafty and his, you know, people won't love to hear this, but as crafty as he is, like drawing fouls when he has an advantage, like what happens if, you know, you're suddenly adding, you know, 10 plays a game where instead of having to create the advantage for himself, he gets the ball with someone closing out on him. So he's already has the advantage there. And that just seems like that makes his life easier. And so, you know, the fact that he was basically the only guy on the Rockets roster who could really, you know, create offense with the ball in his hands last year to any degree of in the playoffs, Josh Smith was probably their second best creator, their second most creative player. And I'm well on record as being a great admirer of Josh Smith's skills, but I think if he's your second best creator, that indicates you have a lack of somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because it brought to mind to me this idea of or there's sort of this perception, right? So they're like Harden's clearly a better player than Lawson. So he's their best offensive player. So he should drive the offense. He should have the ball the majority of the time. He should sort of be the engine for everything. But there's this trade-off, right? So like if Lawson takes some of that, he's probably slightly less efficient in those opportunities that Harden is. But the benefit or the increased efficiency of Harden's opportunities off the ball would maybe offset that. And the analogy that came to mind is not a perfect analogy, but a few years ago, I can't remember which Pacers Heat playoff series it was, but at one point Vogel made this shift where he put Paul George on Dwayne Wade and moved Stevenson to LeBron. And the idea was that even though George is the best defensive player and you'd want him to match up with the best offensive player, George could take more away from Wade than he could from LeBron. And Stevenson could sort of do just enough that trade-off ended up being a net positive.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's sort of analogous to, you know, the debate about Kevin Love and how he was being used in Cleveland last year. It's like, especially Love seemed like he was banged up a little bit, wasn't super mobile. And so, yeah, you could have done different things to be better for Kevin Love and Kevin Love's stats. I wasn't convinced that doing those things would have been better for the offense as a whole. You know, it's like you using him as a kind of a spot up weak side shooter is maybe a waste of Kevin Love, but that may have been the best use to within Cleveland's overall offense, given, you know, what they had last year. So, you know, and I think also having that, getting back to Houston, having that secondary creator, I think also just makes things easier for kind of the other three guys on the floor. Rather than kind of just standing around kind of waiting for Harden to do something, there's going to be many more but there's going to be more opportunities where, you know, Harden makes a play, gets a little bit of a crease, throws the ball to Lawson, who now attacks an advantage and creates a better opportunity for somebody, or vice versa. So just having that second person who can kind of, you know, the something the Spurs have been great at for years, kind of, you know, picking at the scab almost of, you know, we've gotten that one little edge and the next person's going to keep exploiting it and keep exploiting it and keep exploiting it until we find a wide open three or a dunk or something like that. And just Houston now has a little bit more of that ability that they didn't have last year, that it was a little bit of kind of what Chandler Parsons gave them the year before, is that that ability to kind of catch the ball with an advantage and make a play. And they go from kind of having nobody who could do that, because the guy who could do that always had the ball, to, with them sharing the floor, they're always going to have at least one guy off the ball who can who can kind of catch an attack.
How much do you think the Rockets will be able to get away with playing them together defensively? And if they do, do you think that's usually with Beverly as the third backcourt player, and Harden's playing small forward, or however you want to define it, or do you think they're playing together with Beverly on the bench?
I think that depends both on matchups, but how much they can get away with it depends hugely on Dwight Howard. Even kind of limited, he was still in some ways a pretty effective defensive anchor last year. And if he can, I don't think he's ever going to be Orlando Dwight again, but if he can be just really good rim presence, rim deterrent Dwight, that allows, a whole lot more kind of in terms of the porousness you can kind of have on the perimeter. And also I think that with less of a ball handling responsibility, Harden's defense will improve, just because from an energy standpoint, he won't be expending as much, having to create every offensive play.
It's interesting too, because they sort of have just as much of a sort of a tangled rotational knot in the front court, between Howard and Mata Yunus, and Capella seems like he's ready to start commanding a certain number of minutes as well.
Yeah, that seems like that's almost a good problem. They have so many kind of pieces and young guys to kind of fit around. Not all of them are going to work out. I mean, Capella, Harrell, Decker. To the extent that KJ McDaniels is going to play some small forward, Mota Yunus, Terrence Jones, that's a lot of people we're talking about here. And, Trevor Ariza, if they can, might end up at some small ball four, that's a lot of different things. That's a lot of lottery tickets almost they have to find a workable rotation. It's also a lot of skill versatility, which I think is something that is becoming increasingly important to in the past couple of years. There's like, all right, this is the Maury Ball way we're going to play, it's fastball, and now they have a change up and a curve, and it being the baseball playoffs, those are the analogies I'm going with now. But that's something that, we saw with the Warriors against, both the Grizzlies and in the finals against the Cavs. I mean, kind of having that, well, let's try this. Okay, this series is over now. Kind of having that ability to morph and make your team a little bit different is something that San Antonio has done very well over the years too. And the Rockets seem like, with a reasonable amount of like health, luck, and all that kind of stuff, and some development from a couple players, that they'll have that ability too to kind of change and shift the way they want to play a little bit to best exploit the opposition's weaknesses, and that's a nice card to be able to play.
With the way they've changed their roster, do you think the Thunder have picked up some of that ability this year? I mean, obviously it remains to be seen what Donovan does and how he sort of sets everything up, but it seems to me like they have more. It seems to me like there's more sort of adaptability in their pieces than I recall them having the past few years.
The problem is there's a few of the pieces I just don't like.
there's a lot of either or, right?
Yeah.
So it's like Cantor's offense is a sacrifice on defense, Morrow's 3-point shooting or Roberson's wing defense, but sort of nobody gives you a little bit of both. Everybody gives you a lot of one thing.
Yeah. And I think that's really been the complaint about, them for a couple of years, I think, not to It's kind of, why is their offense so clunky? Well, it's because that's the guys they have who can do things with the ball are two. So, you know, even Ibaka, who I think is an all-star level player, is not necessarily a guy who, you know, you can throw the ball and say, go do something and expect good things to happen. So it's almost natural that how kind of stagnant their offense can and has become. But that's, that's getting into my Scottie Brooks wasn't that bad defense tirade. But you won't have Scottie to kick around anymore, guys. So, if they weren't seemingly beholden to play Cantor huge minutes, I think Steven Adams is just a plain better player. I think that it's entirely possible that Mitch McGarry is a more effective overall player this year. That doesn't mean that Cantor can't be a useful kind of situational, because his ability to, score it's considerable. But whether that's, how necessary is that on a team with Durant and Westbrook and are you giving more than you're getting kind of their starting lineup? And if you're paying him this, gazillion dollars, are you, beholden to play him 32 minutes a night, regardless of how much sense that might make? So,
well, isn't the appeal of Cantor, right, that he could be the key to unlocking something more sort of creative out of Durant and Westbrook? They haven't had a player as talented as him offensively to go with them. Ibaka can space the floor, which is great, but he is limited in other ways, and Cantor can sort of, he can post up, he can finish in the pick and roll, he can make some simple passes out of the pick and roll, and he can shoot, and so that he's sort of, he would be the key to turning them into something other than what they've been in the past.
It's still, what do you think, his best skills are still, even though he does it from a different spot on the floor, are still kind of the same, all right, throw him the ball, something happens. It's not, can he make passes out of the pick and roll? Have we seen that? Now, part of that is, he hasn't necessarily in Utah gotten the opportunity to play with a lot of crafty pick and roll players. So that's an open question. But at the same time, it's still a his best usage is still, his best individual contributions kind of come from, him stopping the ball and doing something with it, which, at a certain level of abstraction is kind of, well, that's Westbrook and Durant also. So you're kind of adding another guy who it's not just your turn, my turn. It's your turn, my turn, his turn now.
Almost. Yeah.
That's not the only way it can work, but that's, it's not the most natural compliment. I'll say that there are kind of other, it's obviously it's not really a comparison in terms of overall skill, but you look at say like an Al Horford or something like that, who, in addition to being able to score and probably isn't like the pure scorer that Cantor is, but can do all those things, can hit a jumper out of the pick and roll, can make a nice pass, can handle the ball, can do all those other things that kind of link between players on an offense that's kind of the player that OKC has been missing. Aside from, Nick Collison is probably the guy who's been their best at those kind of skills over the last couple of years. And, we all love Nick Collison, adjusted plus minus superstar, but you'd hope you could do better. As in terms of like having a guy who can kind of be a complementary offensive piece.
Well, I'm all for Mitch McGarry. He can make some passes, and I don't know if you saw, he was out there hitting corner threes the other night. He made at least two, I think. I'm hoping he gets some run this year. I hope he doesn't get buried behind Cantor and Adams.
Yeah.
All right. Go ahead.
No, that was all. That's all I got.
Okay. So I got a couple minutes of laptop battery here before we die. So just a couple other things you're excited for about this season, either team, players, on-court relationships, that kind of stuff, and then maybe some other data projects you've got your eye on you'd like to get to.
In terms of the rookies, I'm super excited about Moutier. I kind of swooned over him at Summer League. Nothing in preseason has kind of dissuaded me from that. That's the main one. I don't know. I'm just kind of excited for the season to start and for things to be happening instead of just in some ways, this is the most maddening time of year because it's like everyone's so amped up for the season that there's like a lot of passion in the air, but there's no data. So it's just a lot of know this, know that. Sure. You know, it's kind of like the Steve Carell, Stephen Colbert arguments on the old Daily Show. Yeah. Yes, no. And then just data stuff I'm working on. I'm trying to figure out, more passing location kind of stuff. I think I have I have a line on how to figure out kind of not just teammate created shots, both made and missed, and from where the passes are coming. I've done a little bit of work on that in the past, and hopefully I've working with some folks who might be able to help with figuring out that at a kind of an individual shot level rather than kind of on aggregates, and just in general kind of trying to dig deeper into a lot of the stuff I've been looking at over the summer. And then and all that immediately gets shoved to the side is, 2 weeks into the season. Well, look at this is what's happening.
Yeah. And I imagine it'd be nice to have every layer of public sport view data, that we get, everything that deepens that sample. And, we can trust the stuff that we're finding a little bit more. I'm sure it's just icing on the cake too.
Yeah. And also it's kind of, there'll be someday soon when I open the what's new tab on stats.nba.com and they have like the new thing, the new goodies they've unveiled for the season. So I may or may not be checking that page like twice a day. So
that's great. And also, I guess since the last time we recorded a podcast, and it's old news, but so you've taken over as managing editor at Nylon Calculus. A lot of fun new stuff this summer. A couple new faces, some good talented new writers, Nate Duncan and others. A little plug for what's gonna be coming up at Nylon this year.
Just hoping to kind of expand our coverage into other areas. We've got some people who have come on and are going to be doing some more college stuff. I don't know if we're gonna replace like Ken Palm, but just to compliment and to add that layer in, and just a lot of smart people. We've kind of our data wizard Daryl Blackport has kind of found a good way to kind of warehouse data on just the raw data on a daily basis, which be pretty helpful in terms of turning analysis and actually one of the things that's going to allow is kind of more kind of season segment based sport view analysis, which is something that it just hasn't been possible with the public data in years past, just because they don't filter it by date, grumble, but we're going to be able to do that. So we'll kind of see where that leads us. I think that this was the case with you and is the case with me as well, just kind of letting the smart people we have right there kind of find the things that interest them and whether it's, the rivalrous nature of rebounding or just historical jump ball stats, something interesting will come from it. And those are, by the way, those are both articles we've had recently. So if you want to know who the best jump ball taker of the last 15 years is, it's Shaq. Anyway, Matt Femwright did a big deep dive on that recently. So you can find that under our stats at Nylon Calculus.
Yeah, that was great. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Seth. We'll hopefully be checking in with you during the season. And yeah, good to talk.
Yeah, thanks a lot.